Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Tradition stands firm. Two guests and two segments, but one theme. I needed a break from covering the relentless bloodshed in Gaza and the ongoing ravages of the Trump regime. So, a more diverting topic today, overwork and what to do about it. We'll hear from Juliet Shore, one of the prime recent instigators of that line of inquiry, and then Catherine Moose and Noah Martin Wiener, who've been studying overwork among teachers. First, Juliet Shore. In 1992, she published The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure. It turned out to be quite a hit, both within the economics profession and among the general public. Needless to say, this is not the sort of thing most economists write about or even think about. She's been studying work in its various aspects since then, often from a feminist perspective. She's just out with a new book, 4 Days a Week, The Life-Changing Solution for Reducing Employee Stress, Improving Well-Being, and Working Smarter, from Harper Business. That subtitle approaches 18th-century standards of length. She and a large team of researchers have been running pilot programs at worksites around the world, and the book is a report of their findings, which are highly encouraging. Juliet's day job is as a professor of sociology at Boston College. As I said, her research is not typical for economists, which is probably why she's in a sociology department. Juliet Shore. I was amazed to learn that Richard Nixon, of all people, was talking about a 4-day week in 1956. Yeah, that's not something you'd expect out of Richard Nixon. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, I agree. There was a widespread belief that rapid technological progress would lead to more free time. And it's not surprising that people would think that, because beginning in 1870, work time fell steadily in the United States, across all of the early industrializing countries, as a result of the phenomenal productivity gains of industrialization.
Going back a bit, though, in the early parts of the Industrial Revolution, the workday was lengthening, the work week was lengthening, the work life was lengthening.
Absolutely. And that was like one of the big themes of my earlier work, The Overworked American, you know, in which I showed that big rise in work time, but then the decline. And there was just a lot of amnesia about that early period. So in a time like 1956, nobody remembered that industrialization had raised working hours. They just were paying attention to the decline, that century of decline. That was all people knew about it. It was the widespread view that technology drove working hours. And so you have Nixon predicting the 4-day week. You have, soon after that, a sort of panic about the quote-unquote crisis of leisure time. What were people going to do with all this free time that was going to come about by what was at that time quaintly called automation? That continued through into the 1970s, which is the point at which my earlier work shows working hours actually started going in the other direction, rising again in the United States, not elsewhere. That was the conventional wisdom, that we were on a steady path of more and more free time.
So how did the 5-day, 40-hour week become the norm? That norm hasn't changed, even though people are working longer hours, despite the unchanged belief in that norm.
Yeah, and that turns out to be a fascinating story, how the 5-day week came about. If you get your thinking about history from bumper stickers, you will think that it was the union movement that got us a 5-day week. And while there's some truth to that, it actually starts much earlier. And the first group who begins agitating for a 5-day week is Orthodox rabbis, who were upset about the fact that, you know, with the dominance of the Christian Sabbath on Sunday and people working on Saturday, some Reform rabbis were starting to switch their services to Sunday. So they thought that the Jewish Sabbath was going to disappear, and they began agitating for an end to Saturday work. The Jewish garment worker owners, and then in printing and a number of other construction, they started from the 19-teens, you begin to get this movement into the mid-20s to get rid of Saturday work, which is what happened. And then 1926, Henry Ford comes on board and switches Ford. That's the first really big company that does it to a five-day week. Meanwhile, by about the mid-20s, the unions are starting to come around. And then, of course, with the Great Depression, there's a lot of pressure to reduce work time. The country is just at the precipice of going to a 30-hour week as a way of providing more employment. And at the last minute, business resistance leads Roosevelt to switch his support for that. He goes for the National Industrial Recovery Act instead, and eventually the Fair Labor Standards Act, which installs a 40-hour week.
And as you said, work times have been lengthening since the 1970s. We're talking about paid work. What's been happening with household labor?
Household labor, it's a kind of mixed bag of things. On the one hand, as more women have moved into the labor force, particularly mothers, you do get a reduction in household labor. My models show that for every additional hour of paid work a woman works, she reduces at home by half an hour. But you have two counter trends there. One is men are doing a bit more, especially on childcare. And the other really interesting thing is that hours spent on childcare don't decline in the U.S., even with those big increases in women's hours that happened starting in the 1970s and sort of continuing. So you get what's called that intensive mothering model, where mothers are just expected to spend enormous amounts of time with their kids. And that becomes the norm originally in middle class and upper middle class, but then it sort of expands beyond that. So you get a reduction in things like cooking time and house cleaning, but not in childcare.
And international comparisons. The U.S. Has quite long work weeks compared to the work years compared to the rest of the world, right?
Oh, absolutely. Germany has the lowest hours. I mean, on average, they're at about a 32-hour work week if you take their annual hours and divide by 52. Now, they tend to work a longer week and then have long summer vacations. But yeah, pretty much everyone works less than we do. You know, the Germans work about 400 fewer hours a year than we do. And then the French, the Dutch, the Nordic countries, they're all in that 300 hours. Even the Japanese now, who, when I published The Overworked American, you know, were kind of the workaholic country and, you know, had the problem of death from overwork, karoshi, and they were sort of the archetypal overworkers. Japanese work fewer hours than Americans now. And the city government of Tokyo has recently put all of its employees onto a four-day week.
So why do Americans work so much?
It's a combination of things. The first thing I want to say is it's not in our genes. Like, it's not a deep cultural thing. A lot of people think that's what it is, that we're just workaholics. We have the Protestant work ethic. That's what Americans are like. The U.S. led the world in work time reduction until after the Second World War. The big divergence with Europe comes pretty late. It comes like in the 70s and 80s, where we start to increase hours and they stay on that long-term path of hours reduction that began in the 1870s. So what is it? Probably the key thing is the weak and declining power of unions, because by the post-war period, it really was unions who were driving the reduction in work time. Number two, it has to do with the accident of history that led health insurance to be paid by the employer, a crazy system which really distorts labor market outcomes because it means that companies want to hire fewer people because every new person they have to pay health insurance for. And health insurance became very expensive. And there are other sort of per person costs, the way some of our taxes, unemployment insurance, workers' comp, et cetera, they get capped at a certain amount, so extra hours don't incur more taxes. So there's a lot of incentive at the firm level to reduce headcount and lengthen hours. The other thing is that in comparison to lots of other countries, American women work really long hours. A big part of that has been the growth in inequality. There's a growing body of literature showing that more inequality leads to longer working hours. And of course, the U.S. has had a bigger increase in inequality than all of its comparable early industrialized countries.
Okay, let's turn to the book and the research. Now, you're the sole author of the book, but this is a large collective project you're reporting on, right?
Absolutely.
Could you just give some description of the scope of the project, how many people have been working on it, but also what kinds of pilot programs you've got running?
In 2021, height of the pandemic, I was approached by an Irish trade union staffer. He worked for Forza, the largest trade union in Ireland. It's also public sector workers. They wanted to go to 4-day weeks, but they felt they needed private sector proof of concept first. So they're going to run this trial, get private sector employers to give 4-day work weeks with no reduction in pay. He knew my work from the Overworked American and subsequent research and asked me if I would do the research for this trial. And I teamed up with a former student who's in Ireland. And he then teamed up with an NGO called 4-Day Week Global, which was started by a man named Andrew Barnes, who had implemented this at his own financial services company to great success. And now he wanted to spread the word about this. That was the first trial. It started in Feb of 2022. It was pretty small. We had about 15, 17 companies. And then we did a US trial and a big UK trial and a US and an Australasian and a South African and a Brazilian. And then collaborating with people outside of the Anglophone world. So Germany and Portuguese, and now we have collaborators in Scandinavia and other countries. My team is small. We're 4 or 5 people, but we teamed up with people at Cambridge, and we've teamed up with researchers, Portuguese and the Germans, and we have 375 companies, basically, at this point, representing over 10,000 workers in these trials. So this is a large-scale effort.
Okay, now what kind of businesses are these? Like cute little hipster things or more traditional enterprises?
We do have some of those hipsters, but it's really a mix. We've got companies in every kind of industry, but they are very heavily concentrated in white-collar industries. So things like marketing, we have a lot in finance, tech, graphic design, say architecture, lawyers. We have a lot of NGOs. We have healthcare, we have restaurants, we have manufacturing, we have construction, there's retail, pretty much everything. Although, as I say, disproportionately white collar, they do tend to skew smaller. A large fraction are sort of 25 employees or less, but we also have a good number of 200 plus. We have a 1,000-person firm in the UK trial that then is rolling out to all 5,000 of their people. And then we have some really big ones that just did it with divisions, like a 9,000-person marketing firm or a 35,000-person hospital firm, where they're not transitioning the whole company, but just certain divisions.
And the workers, what's the demographic profile?
So they skew a bit female, maybe 60-some percent female, about 60-some percent white. They do cross the age range. I mean, one of the things people think is, oh, this is just a young person's thing. Not true. We've got people across the whole age range. I would say the other big demographic feature of the sample is that 3/4 of them do have a college degree. So in that sense, they're not representative, say, of the U.S. labor force or pretty much any other labor force. So they are a more educated group. When you look at the individual salaries and the household incomes, they're not that far off the median incomes for the United States, for example. They're a little bit better off, but it's not as if these are all upper middle class people.
I'm speaking with Juliet Shore, author of 4-Day Week, just out from Harper Business. I'm guessing this requires changes in work organization, not just adjustments to the work day or work week. What kind of changes in the work organization are required to make this work?
That's such an interesting question. There are a couple of different models. I would say the most common model, and it's the one sort of taught by the NGO, taught by 4-Day Week Global, they give these companies a 2-month onboarding process in which they help them to figure out how it is that you can get rid of low value activities and make your whole work culture more efficient. And I do want to focus on that point about it's a whole organization change. So while there are some individual accommodations, people will do things to make their own work process more efficient if they're people who have a fair amount of control over what they do. But the bulk of this is coming from that organization-wide effort. So they change their meetings culture. There's like a whole science of meetings now and how inefficient a meetings culture has become. That's number one. And the flip side of that is focus time. So they figure out how to stop distractions. And they have different ways of doing this. Some of it's through shared calendars. One company in the UK has like there are like three colors of lights that people can put on their desk. A red light, which is leave me alone, I'm focusing. A yellow light is you can approach, but make sure it's important. And then a green light, open for distraction. Of course, for the manufacturing companies, they do more like a process engineering exercise. And I have a brewery that's been a real success story that I talk about in depth in the book and how they went through every operation and figured out how they could slot this task into the dead time on that task and time and motion studies, like back in the old Taylor-esque era, figuring out how long things should take and found out that things were taking way longer than they needed to. There's another version of this, which is where the 4-day week becomes a forcing function for people to just sort of tighten things up and do things that are more time saving in the long run, but that you might not put the time in early on. And then the final group, restaurants and healthcare, where you have really long days and people burning out and leaving the field in droves. Those companies did not really ask or expect people to intensify those first 4 days. We measure work intensity because we wanted to find out, is this just a speed up? The answer is no. For the most part, work intensity barely goes up. They really are figuring out how to get rid of low value, time wasting stuff. But if you think about a restaurant kitchen or you think about a healthcare context, they don't have meetings. They don't have wasted time. They've already engineered all that waste out. Their people just need a break. They have to either hire new people, and the restaurants do a little bit of that, or change their division of labor to be able to give somebody that extra day off. And that's what we see they're doing successfully. So I call those 180-80 companies. The original model is 180-100. People get 100% of the pay, 80% of the time, but they have to do 100% of the work. In the 180-80, they get the money, they get the time off, they're not expected to do more.
You know, as I was reading the book, I was thinking of David Graeber's, I can't say the word on the radio, the FCC won't let us, bull jobs. And I just interviewed my friend Lee Claire LaBerge, who has a new book out called Fake Work, which is a memoir of her time, fresh out of college, working for a consulting firm. And what she was doing was absolute nonsense for much of the day. I do wonder how some of these jobs, people are just wasting their time unproductively in any social sense. How does your work relate to that kind of critique?
There's sort of two pieces here. I mean, of course, with bull jobs, you have two dimensions of it. One is like the stupid stuff that people have to do in any job or in a job. And that 4-day week does a lot to eliminate that. It really forces these companies to be intentional about what they're doing and forces people to be intentional. So they don't have to do a lot of that time-wasting stuff. When I was in grad school, my advisor, Sam Bowles, did a lot of work on figuring out what kinds of jobs in our economy are really not worthwhile. I mean, it was a sort of precursor to what Graeber would later do, and they called them guard labor. That was jobs that were just there to keep an unfair, dysfunctional system going, and it was a very large number of jobs. Or jobs that just don't really serve a social purpose. Like you think about advertising and marketing, there really isn't a social purpose there. And yet lots of people work in those. So the 4-day week, it's not going to eliminate that source of bull jobs, but it can make the actual work process a lot better. And what we find is the people are so much more engaged in their work. They feel much more productive. They feel more on top of their work. They're just much happier at work. I mean, we have 20 well-being metrics that soar as a result of the four-day week. And some of them have to do with stuff happening outside of work, that people sleep more and they exercise more. They have more time for their family, friends, social life, and all of that. But it's also that while they're at work, they're just much happier. They feel better about the work itself. They feel more on top of it. It does eliminate one dimension of what Graeber is talking about.
The workers in your surveys do report great improvements in their well-being, right?
Absolutely. I mean, huge. I mean, it's like life-changing, transformational, best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, it's over-the-top, game-changer kind of sentiments.
And what about employers? Now, bosses are legendary for wanting to squeeze out that extra drop of blood, and you're talking about a blood retention strategy. How do they feel about this?
Okay, so, you know, this is a self-selected group. These are employers who decided to do this. They're pretty much also mostly over the moon. They rate these trials very highly, like in the 8.5 on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of overall. They say that productivity is maintained or improved for the most part. For some of them, it's also or even primarily about retention. The case I start the book with is a marketing team where 30 to 40% turnover annually is the norm in that industry. And that team went to zero turnover. And we have a lot of cases where people will tell us not one person has quit. And remember, this is happening during the Great Resignation, some of this research. And then you get an incredible labor market advantage. So we have people telling us, like, they post a job, they get 1,000 applicants where their friends are struggling to get people to apply. So the companies have a lot of benefits that they're seeing from this. And, you know, economists don't believe you have these kinds of situations where both sides can benefit like this. But we are very much hearing that from the companies as well as from the employees.
Are these changes, that these positive effects that people report, durable, or is it just the novelty of it and then the effect wears off?
Yeah, well, we worried about that. There were a bunch of other rebound effects we worried about too, none of which happened. So we survey at baseline, meaning before a company starts, and then at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and 24 months. And the results are all durable, very small changes in some of them, but for the most part, everything pretty much holds. But the one thing I have to say about it is we do get a lot of survey attrition, companies who just don't respond to us, or employee, you know, low response rates. So I'm a little less confident at the 24 month. I have no reason to think that the results drop off. It's just the sample is not as robust as it is, for example, at the 12 month.
Now, you report testifying before Bernie Sanders subcommittee, the Senate, and made me wonder about the political prospects for this agenda at the current moment. Despite Trump's long stretches of executive time and golfing vacations, this doesn't seem like the most propitious of moments for this agenda. What do you think of the political prospects over the longer term?
I do think it's going to stay on the table. AI is the main reason why, because we've got these big labor displacing technological changes coming. And then the question is, what do we do about work time? And recently, Senator Sanders was on Joe Rogan's podcast talking about this again, because the AI conversation that he's trying to have is who's going to benefit and shouldn't workers get more free time as a result of this? My understanding is that the UAW is going to make the 32-hour week one of the three main demands for its 2028 contract.
Oh, and they're supposed to have a general strike, too.
Exactly. And this is going to be in there, like, big time, is what I'm hearing. Now, it's just what I'm hearing at this point. But here's a couple of other interesting pieces that are happening. So in Maine, a GOP legislator just introduced a bill for a pilot, which is basically similar to what our pilots were, but it's a government-sponsored pilot with a tax incentive for companies to join. And we've been involved in researching government-sponsored pilots in other countries already. New York also has a bill. Farrah Forrest of Brooklyn has put in two bills, one for public sector, one for private sector workers for New York State. We've had a bill introduced here. So I think we're going to see a couple of these state level pilots go through. And I think the pilots will be powerful because if they have the same results we have had, including the government pilots that we've researched, you're going to see benefits for both the employers and the workers, and that's going to help propel. I do feel that the pandemic transformed the sort of hegemonic thinking on this, that it went from being something that people thought of as aspirational but totally unrealistic to feeling like common sense. I think it has a hegemonic quality now.
Finally, if I may channel a neoclassical economist right now, if this is so great, why haven't we done it already?
There's a lot of inertia. We see already the big firms haven't really jumped onto this yet. And control, you know, for the same reason that these companies are trying to bring workers back, even though it doesn't seem like an economically smart thing to do. I think that's a big part of it. But it's also that the pandemic changed the equation of the workforce. It made people more stressed out. It made them less willing to sort of just go along on the worker side. And then on the employer side, one of the things I heard from a number of employers is the pandemic taught us that we could do work from home. We thought we couldn't do that. You could ask the same question about work from home because that technology had been there forever, but they wouldn't allow people to do it. But work from home worked. And so we thought, well, maybe this could work too.
That was Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College and author of 4 Days a Week, just out from Harper Business. I say with some pride that Farah Souffrant Forrest, who has introduced 2 shorter workweek bills in the New York State Assembly, is my personal rep in that chamber. That's a substantial compensation for having neoliberal tool Hakeem Jeffries as my congressperson and Chuck Schumer as my almost neighbor. He lives a mile and a half away. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
And he was a Catholic, the ethic ran through his bones. He lived alone with his mother, collecting gossip and toys. Every Sunday when he went to church, he'd kneel in his pew and he'd say, "It's work, all that matters is work." He was a lot of things. What I remember the most, he'd say, "I got to bring home the bacon. Someone's got to bring home the roast." He'd get to the factory early. If you asked him, he'd have told you straight out, "It's work." No matter what I did, it never seemed enough. He said I was lazy, I said I was young. He said, "How many songs did you write?" "I'd written 0, I'd like to say 10. You won't be young forever. You should have written 15. It's work."
That was a dissenting perspective from Lou Reed. Work, from his and John Cale's memorial to Andy Warhol, Songs for Drella. Next, teachers and overwork. Teachers are often paid considerably less than other similarly credentialed professionals, in large part because the field is dominated by women and because the job is seen as a form of care work, which suffers an economy-wide wage penalty, as we'll hear. My favorite factoid along these lines is that child care workers are paid less than parking lot attendants. Many teachers are seriously overworked and stressed. My next guests, Catherine Moose and Noah Martin Wiener, have a paper in the Economic and Labor Relations Review reporting on focus groups they held with teachers on the topic of their work lives and the psychological and emotional toll they take. Perhaps surprisingly, they faced some skepticism from the teachers when they suggested maybe figuring out how they could work less. They're both in the economics department at the University of Massachusetts, Moose as an assistant professor and Wiener as a senior lecturer. Catherine Moose and Noah Martin Wiener. So let's start by talking about a bit about the stress level among teachers. I'm gathering it's rather high.
Yes. So we did 4 focus group interviews with public school teachers in Massachusetts of different levels, elementary, middle, high school, and then a mixed group. And the stress levels were pretty consistent. Overwhelm came up a lot, feeling burnt out, high levels of stress. One of the topics that came up a lot that was a cause of stress was the evaluation by their principals and the role that standardized testing has played into being evaluated and all of the increased paperwork that they're now responsible for. The more seasoned teachers certainly described there's an increase in that over the course of their 20 or 30 year career and that has created a lot more stress.
There has been a push for a four-day week. You think that's not enough?
Our idea was, and this is a misunderstanding that came up also during the interviews, is that a lot of these teachers interpreted what we were proposing as a reduction in the school week to 4 days, whereas what we were trying to think about was a reduction in teachers' work week that still went along with 5 days of school for students, right?
Parents would not be happy with a four-day week.
Right, and we are parents, so we're very sympathetic to that. And so our vision that we wanted to test out on teachers and see what their feedback was a reduction in working hours for teachers, but maintaining both their pay level and the hours of instruction that students receive. Because when there's no school on Fridays, students don't have the instructional time, even if it's made up in other places. They miss out on the meals that are extremely important for millions of children. And parents are scrambling to provide care. They often have to pay for it. That was very much not our vision. It was something that would require job sharing and increased investment.
I notice you use the phrase an abundance approach, which is a loaded word these days, but how does that differ from what else has been floating around?
Yeah, well, when we came up with that, I did not know about Ezra Klein's forthcoming book. So I was not following his work closely enough if he was already using that phrase.
That's okay. You're excused.
Thank you. But I'm actually very glad you brought it up, because I regret that we're both using that phrase, because this is not about deregulation. This is not about loosening markets at all. This is about much more investment. Schools already in the U.S. in many communities are the hub of the community. They're often one of the largest employers, particularly in rural districts. They're places that families really rely on. They build community. They, as I said, provide food and medical care. And we want to really reinforce this and support this and help this flourish. I think our vision was starting with teachers to improve their working conditions, that would potentially have some positive spillover effects for other workers and professionals in the school, and then perhaps in the rest of the neighboring economy. Our vision was that schools could really be the catalyst for all kinds of positive change for labor relations.
Now, the labor movement used to be interested in shorter working hours, but doesn't seem so much anymore. I did some interviews quite a while back in which people said, like, the auto workers are just not interested in a shorter work week. They wanted the overtime. So what happened with the whole less work agenda that used to be somewhat central to the labor movement?
Yeah, that was a big part of our motivation for this, because I had worked earlier on studying the factory acts and the demand for shorter hours and how tied that is to gender and questions of social reproduction, and what a historic, you know, importance that was in terms of the labor movement, in terms of shortening working hours. And then over the course of the last century or so, the U.S. labor movement has been much more concerned about actually hoarding hours and actually getting workers overtime pay and increasing their pay, even if that means they work really, really long hours or set a standard of 40 hours. And I think that has made it hard for people, whether they're union members like the teachers we spoke to, who are all members of their teachers' unions, or people unattached to a labor union, have a hard time imagining that could be something that they fight for or something that they want. That was part of our curiosity, was what would it take to pique this political imagination with regard to reducing working hours? Because as parents of young children, we think of that as a really core piece of what makes our lives work, is that we have some flexibility and autonomy and control of our working hours. But that's not true for so many U.S. workers.
And you mentioned gender. This is a field that is very heavily female, especially for the younger students. And it's often perceived as a kind of care work, and especially for the younger students, which means less pay very often, but also, not taking the job as seriously as it should be as a profession. Talk some about the gendered angle on the profession.
The teaching profession is still very much a female-dominated profession. It becomes a little bit more gender balanced, as you said, as it goes up towards secondary schooling. But there's, you know, a large literature on the care work wage penalty. And so that includes education, where workers in care sectors experience lower wages when compared to workers in non-care sectors with comparable levels of education. There's different theories of why this is, the attribution of the care work wage penalty to the economic dependence of care recipients. So children being in this vulnerable position, the association of care work and femininity and mothering and the devaluation of those things in our society. And also some difficulty in like assessing the productivity of care professionals.
Well, also it's just like women love that kind of work, right? So they don't need the pay.
Exactly. Well, that was the thing I was going to say, is that there's also, you know, thoughts that their intrinsic motivation is enough, you know, like just the satisfaction you get from helping people or caring for children or caring for the sick or elderly is enough. And you get these sort of psychic rewards. That's certainly a motivation for people in care work and in education. And that came up a lot in our findings, that they love teaching, they love their students, but they also deserve to be paid well. And they also leave the profession if they can't, if they're not being
exactly
compensated.
Yeah, I think that's what we find a lot in these interviews, is that this is the intrinsic motivation is what is comes under pressure if there's this time constraint, if there's just not enough time to do this job in the way that people really want to do. You know, they want to take care. There's this desire, this wish to do a good job. And time is really a fundamental constraint, I think, is what comes out in this research.
And how does the pay compare to other similarly credentialed fields? I mean, these are professionals, often with advanced degrees, but they're not paid like it always, right?
They do face a wage penalty compared to other college-educated workers. So the Economic Policy Institute has done some interesting work looking at the wage penalty that teachers specifically face when compared to other professionals of similar education levels. Mm-hmm.
And we should say that you did this research with Massachusetts teachers. Massachusetts is, I think, 100% unionized and very well paid by national standards. The educational system is highly regarded. What you found is probably the best for many situations in the country.
I think that that's a fair assumption, that we're looking at a high income state with a lot of support for public education. Per pupil spending is higher than most states. Teacher salaries are also on the higher end, but there's also a lot of inequality from district to district. So, and that came up in our discussions as well, is that some districts pay much better than others. So there's also inequality within the state.
And there is a connection with the time constraint again, because people have to live sometimes further away from their schools. So that adds commute time to the total work hours in a day. So if people can't afford to live where they work, it means they have to compensate somewhat with time. And that has also been coming up in our research.
Your research, how did you go about this? Did focus groups, who were the participants?
So we were able to recruit teachers. We restricted our sample to public school teachers in either elementary or secondary schools in Massachusetts. And we were able to get a sample of 19 teachers, ultimately, most of them about equally distributed between elementary, middle, and high schools. Almost all of them were women. Almost all of them were more experienced teachers with longer years of experience. And that is just an unfortunate, you know, reality about the time that we were able to schedule these focus groups. And it's just hard to get teachers with small children, for example, that we were very interested in learning from. And also, you know, the teachers are mostly white women.
We should say that a focus group is not a rigorous public opinion survey, but it's intended to draw out more detail than a poll could draw out, and also more in the way of subjective feelings, right? This is a different research strategy from just polling 1,000 teachers in Massachusetts.
Exactly. And actually, for us as economists, it was a different strategy than we usually take, which is to just sort of crunch the numbers and look at their revealed preference. Oh, they work long hours. They must like working a lot of hours. That's the typical economics approach.
That's one of my favorite economics concepts, the
revealed preference. Yeah. It's very satisfying to reinforce your preconceived notions. The other thing that we did that was not nationally representative, but is we had the teachers fill out a time diary. Time use surveys are very important in feminist economics because they are the only way that we can really know about or measure unpaid work. We had them fill out for a typical day. And that's how we started our conversations was actually with the teachers was, what was it like filling out this survey? What did it make you feel? And it was very interesting that it really brought up a lot of strong emotions for a lot of the teachers to actually quantify how they spend their time and to realize how much time they spend worrying about.
I'm speaking with Catherine Moose and Noah Martin Wiener, authors of a paper on addressing overwork among teachers. It's interesting that some of your participants didn't even realize how hard they were working until they filled this form out.
Yeah, that was a big finding for us that came right off the bat was
almost all of them work more than 8 hours a day when you take account of all the paid and unpaid work that they certainly, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of their work occurs outside the classroom, and that's not really part of the compensation arrangements, right? They're basically working for free.
Mm-hmm.
What did they report? How overworked are they, and what are the consequences of that?
They reported a lot of stress and overwhelm. People said things like they're running on empty. They are not sure how much longer they can stay with teaching. They, you know, threatened to go out on medical leave. This is, you know, someone who has a good rapport with their principal, I guess. And that it makes a big impact on their motivation to keep teaching, their sort of patience, as well as their family relationships. Many of the teachers who do have children mentioned feeling like once they get home, they don't have a lot of energy for their kids because they're still thinking about their students. And then also their own physical health and emotional health and well-being took a hit because of that.
And these are people who really like their jobs and are not given to slacking, right?
Not at all. I mean, and these are the people that responded to the recruitment email, right? So these are people who are engaged enough.
There may be a selection bias there.
Yes, there's a bit of a selection bias in the fact that they're reading the emails from the union that had the blurb recruiting them for this. And they were very motivated and conscientious. And one of our big findings was when we asked them, you know, what would you do if you had 8 more hours of time, you know, if there were one fewer day of teaching per week. And what really took me surprise was how many of them said, oh, I would catch up on grading. I would plan really cool lessons. I would learn more about the technology that I could use to improve my teaching. Many of them said, basically, I would do more unpaid teaching work, which was not what I was expecting. I mean, some of them did say, oh, I'll go to a museum or I'll go on a trip or something like that. But they're so motivated that even when confronted with the hypothetical idea of free time, they were thinking about improving their teaching, not about their own leisure.
So what strategies do they have for coping with the situation that they find themselves in now?
Yeah, so they had quite a few different strategies. Some of it was related to working with their unions and collective bargaining. These were, again, all union members, and there may have been a selection bias in terms of how involved they were in their union. A lot of people brought up setting personal boundaries, and that came up, especially the more seasoned teachers who had been through COVID and had really relaxed all of their boundaries when there was teaching from home. And remote teaching, that they were starting to put up more boundaries. I'm going to turn off my work emails. I'm not going to check them. I'm not going to, you know, make certain calls in my free time. A few of them had experience with co-teaching or collaborating with other teachers. And then it also came up that exit or quitting or getting a new job was one strategy that they had considered. These were current teachers, so that wasn't the case. But it certainly is for those who aren't in the profession anymore.
And what has, I think you mentioned this a little bit, but let's talk about it some more. What has neoliberal education reform over the last couple of decades done to the job and how they experience it?
That came up a lot in terms of, you know, the increased surveillance and the increased testing that came up a lot. They're preparing students for standardized tests. In Massachusetts, we have the MCAS, which soon will not be a graduation requirement, although it will continue. But that is, I think, an important win for improving public education. But another thing that came up and we tied to the care wage penalty literature was the responsabilization of teachers as part of what's happened to them in the neoliberal era. So there have been, you know, austerity and cuts, but increases in what teachers are being asked to do with fewer resources. So they're experiencing it from both sides. And then we saw them really take that on and thinking like they're being tasked to sort of solve societal problems that are beyond their classroom. I mean, the kids show up coming from a community that is struggling financially, and the teachers are the ones who are supposed to fix all the problems, or also the parents, rather than society. So that's been a big shift also in the material conditions and the working conditions of teachers, but also in their self-perception and understanding of their career.
COVID, I'm sure, didn't help.
No. I mean, that came up a lot in terms of both having to work all the time during COVID, to adopt the new technology, to meet all of the students' challenges. And then when they get back to the classroom, it came up a lot, particularly the elementary school teachers, where students were missing a lot of basic skills, social skills, emotional skills, and even tactile, like using scissors and things like that, that they didn't get at home. They didn't have the resources, or the parents weren't aware that that was something they needed to be working on. So that put a lot of stress on teachers as both higher standards, that I should say, that are tied to the increase in standardized testing. But then there's also a lot more social and emotional and behavioral issues that teachers are responsible for.
Every time I hear about people homeschooling their kids, I think, man, that's a hard job. You really have to know what you're doing. It's not something you can just like step in as an amateur and do. It requires a lot of preparation and skill and experience. And I don't think that gets fully appreciated by the broader population, how hard a job this is and how you really do have to know what you're doing.
I absolutely agree with you wholeheartedly. yeah, I think that there's quite a lot of hubris in the idea that, you know, anyone can just do what a trained professional does, and that anyone, that you could do it as well, and that you could do it for each level as your child gets older, or if you have multiple children. I also think that part of the movement away from public education and towards homeschooling is, you know, a profoundly neoliberal one in saying that we should, you know, all have our own little homestead, our own little, you know, there is no society. And part of being in a public school is being part of society and teaching children that they are, that they're valuable members of society, but they also, you know, have a responsibility to it. And that's one of the things that the kids didn't get when they were in remote schooling, was interacting with 20 or 30 other kids their age, learning how to work through conflict, learning how to share, all of those things that are really essential to society.
It seems that decades of austerity and speed up have done things to the consciousness of the working class, none of them very good. But it seems like the teachers you talked to had a hard time imagining a different way of doing things. Is that correct?
That certainly came up, I think, was the things that had curtailed their political imagination. I mean, there were some teachers, I should say, who, when we sort of floated the idea of a work time reduction without loss of pay, were like, sign me up. I'm going to sign that contract on the dotted line right now. Of course, it wasn't a real contract. But there are other ones, and I would say more of them were much more skeptical that there would be the money for that, the political will. And they're not wrong to doubt that. I mean, this was floated as a pie in the sky hypothetical, but also that, like I said, that they could get more leisure time. I mean, that was sort of beyond the political imagination for a lot of them, that they would actually be the winner of time or of free time. Instead, it was a way to sort of make their job a little bit calmer, easier, have more autonomy. One participant talked about, oh, it'd be really cool to get to work in a coffee shop and be treated like a professional. And we were thinking, you are a professional. I mean, you should already be treated that way, even if you need to be in the school building most of the time. So yeah, I think that the consciousness of teachers as members of the working class has really been affected by both the fact that it is a feminized profession, a caring profession, and the neoliberalization of public education.
And then one that's under constant political attack and public attack. I mean, this is the scorn for a lot of teachers that floats around. It'd be really hard if I were one.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it seemed to us in our research that the discourse had sort of shifted. I mean, there was certainly a few decades ago, the way people talked about teachers, I think, as just very diminishing. But I think that most people do support, polls show that most people do support their public school teachers and most people do support their schools. I think one of our colleagues has found that people think, oh, it's the other schools that are the problem. It's somebody else's school that's the problem. And I think COVID did, for people who stuck through with the public schools, did actually help people appreciate what teachers do. But does that translate into policy or to increased funding? No. I mean, we're seeing the opposite, of course, with the current administration.
Finally, I could imagine some conservative listening to this and saying, oh, whine. You know, you folks, you work from 9 to 3 and then you have summers off. What are you complaining about? What do you say to that imagined conservative?
Well, yeah, first off, teachers don't work from 9 to 3, right? Teachers, what we do find during the school week and the weekends during the school year, teachers work a lot of hours, more than many other similar professionals in other fields. And so I think teachers have a very hard job and they are really stretched very, very thin. And giving teachers more time would just have tremendous payoff for the communities that they're in, for the students that they teach.
Yeah, I mean, that was another thing that came up for some of our participants was that they reported really long hours. I mean, one person reported working from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. the most recent day. Not everyone had quite as long hours, but longer than, you know, 9 to 3 for sure. But then they also, they get that message like, oh, you've got such a cushy deal. You don't work summers. But the truth is that a lot of them are spending several weeks unpaid in the summer preparing for the next year or breaking down from the previous year, you know. And there's lots of unpaid work time. There was sort of this duality for teachers. Like they reported these really long hours, but then they said, well, you know, people say we work these actually short hours. And so I think that's also part of the conflicts in their own perception as workers.
Those are Catherine Moose and Noah Martin Wiener, both of the UMass Economics Department. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a more dystopian take on the issue, The Godfather's 1988 classic, Birth, School, Work, Death. Till next week, bye.
We turn around from upside down, but all it seems shut off, drown. For torture, off no pain, just like that film of Michael Caine. I've been abused, I've been confused, and I've kissed my reflexive shoes.